Hello, and welcome to the CME presentation entitled Optimal Management of the Obesity-Related Comorbidities in the Bariatric Surgery Patient. I'm Dr. Christopher Still, internist and medical director of the Center for Nutrition and Weight Management at Geisinger Medical Center in Danville, Pennsylvania. I'm very pleased to be joined today with two colleagues, Jamie Seiler, physician assistant within the Center for Nutrition and Weight Management, and Tasa Dersham, also within the Center for Nutrition. Welcome. Bariatric surgery, or obesity surgery, is a common and effective treatment modality for morbid obesity and its comorbid medical problems. And in fact, at the end of this year, some 250,000 bariatric procedures are expected to be performed. However, bariatric surgery is just a tool, and it's our hope that after this presentation, you'll have a better understanding of bariatric surgery, its indication, its expected outcomes, and most importantly, to care for the patients both before and after the surgical procedure. Even the best surgical procedure should only be looked at as a tool. The most important components are the cornerstone, and that being diet and exercise and behavior modification. When choosing an institution for bariatric surgery, you want to consider the whole comprehensive approach and not just the surgery. At the end of the surgical process, the most important part is their pre- and post-operative care. So as you're choosing the institutions, you want to look for an institution that does a significant number of bariatric surgery or even a center of excellence, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So why would anybody consider bariatric surgery? We know that if a person has a body mass index of 40 or more, there's a 12-fold increase in mortality just for having that body mass index, in addition to all the comorbidities that they have, such as diabetes, sleep apnea. There's a decreased quality of life. And the most important indication, in my opinion, is the resolution or the curing of the comorbid medical problems. Weight loss is really secondary to the profound medical benefits that a bariatric surgery procedure can ensue. After bariatric surgery, we talked about how it can cure a lot of medical problems, so it stands to reason that a person has a lot of comorbid medical problems prior to surgery. So we hope that we'll have a better understanding of both the pre-op process and also the post-operative process. So you can see every organ system is directly related or affected by obesity. Obstructive sleep apnea, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. So we need to come up with a treatment approach to identify these individuals, to screen them preoperatively, to decrease their risk perioperatively. To ensure optimal preoperative control, we're going to look at cardiovascular disease, pulmonary disease, endocrinologic diseases, and also sleep disorders specifically. If we look at the cardiovascular system, everyone always wonders about stress testing. Stress testing is a very common procedure being done, and in my opinion, it is not really warranted in every bariatric surgery patient. There are plenty of programs, however, that will do a stress test on everybody just because they think they're at high risk. But in fact, I think that they have a much higher risk of having obstructive sleep apnea and requiring a polysomnogram or sleep study than the need for a stress test. So what are some indications for stress tests? Jamie, do you want to talk about what we do at our institution with regards to our proven care?
Sure. Certainly, I think everyone with atypical chest pain or a history of coronary artery disease warrants a stress test before surgery. And we also have a list of criteria that we use based on evidence-based medicine. And if patients have 2 to 3 of those criteria, we'll get a stress test. 3 to 4, we'll place a cardiology consult. And those include things such as age greater than 65, diabetes greater than 10 years, a history of heart disease, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's important is if their creatinine is increased. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the reason that is important because there's a lot of fluid that we can give perioperatively. Mm-hmm. So you're right. So if they have 2 of these, we get a stress test. Mm-hmm. And greater than 2 or 5, we order a cardiology consult. Mm-hmm. So I think there's no one right answer, but I think trying to having a criteria set up preoperatively, those patients are assigned to these criteria. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of 5 years, we can look back and say, are we stressing enough patients? Are we stressing too few? Right. So I think that the misnomer is that everybody's got cardiovascular disease, and that's not really the case. And more younger and younger females specifically, 80% of bariatric surgery procedures are being done on females, are being performed, clearly they are not at higher risk for cardiovascular disease that one may think.
Right.
If you were to order a stress test, which stress test is the best?
We certainly utilize a stress echo on a frequent basis. That can cause some problems just in not getting good windows because of the body habitus. So a nuclear stress test can be utilized as well.
Yeah, stress echo is great. You can get a resting echo, EKG, and then a stress echo. But unfortunately, with the average weight of our patients undergoing surgery is about 310 pounds, we do very few stress echoes.
Right.
So the nuclear studies seem to be best
in
that patient population. How about EKGs?
We get EKGs on everyone over age 45 or, again, with a history of heart disease. I think the 12-lead EKG is an important tool to help us diagnose previous MI, any kind of rhythm disturbances or bundle branch block before surgery.
Yeah, that's important because if anything would go on perioperatively, you have a comparison.
Right.
There's another indication, I think, that may be the most important indication for an EKG, and that's looking at the QT interval. Obesity, obese individuals, or obesity itself, predisposes individuals to prolonged QT interval prolongation. And so you want to check an EKG, and if it's greater than 460 milliseconds, then you just need to watch those patients very closely. You shouldn't you don't need to stop their beta blockers or the calcium channel blockers for that reason, but what has been shown to prolong the QT is electrolytes. So hypokalemia, hypophosphatemia, so you really want to keep an eye on those. And in fact, there are some people that do bowel preps on everybody preoperatively. That can also cause electrolyte disturbances and hence lengthen the QT interval prolongation. If we turn now to pulmonary, as I said, I think pulmonary disease is one of the most common and underdiagnosed comorbid medical problems, specifically with obstructive sleep apnea. It's often overlooked and underdiagnosed. These individuals can go through their whole night trying to sleep, but they never get down into REM sleep. So they wake up very early morning headaches. They're tired because they really haven't had any rest. They haven't got down into the REM sleep. They have significant daytime somnolence. They're often misdiagnosed with depression or chronic fatigue syndrome. So I think if you're going to choose one test on any patient, you have a best chance of picking up obstructive sleep apnea. Now, it's hard to determine who we're going to put a sleep study. I mean, we do 20 surgeries a week. We can't study 20 patients every week. So what has been the common practice for screening for obstructive sleep apnea?
We use the Flemmens criteria, which is a questionnaire based on history of hypertension, snoring, and waking up gasping, choking, or snorting, along with a neck circumference.
Yep.
And that's based on a numerical scale, and anything greater than 15 indicates a higher risk of sleep apnea, which is when we proceed with a polysomnogram.
Yeah, it's been shown that the neck circumference is more sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I think screening for obstructive sleep apnea is warranted, and I really don't fault programs, in my opinion, that screen everybody. It's just in larger programs, you just don't have enough space.
Right.
So one thing that I think is important, the polysomnogram is the gold standard. There are some insurances that do not reimburse for the polysomnogram, so you have to do a nocturnal pulse ox first. If they become hypoxic on that, then they'll go on to the polysomnogram. But a lot of times patients are diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea. They have their CPAP, but they're not wearing it.
Right.
So anybody that is newly diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea that warrants CPAP, or anybody that has the diagnosis of, they need to wear their CPAP for at least 2 weeks prior to surgery. That is the minimum amount of time for the physiologic benefit, because it will help decrease brain swelling, cerebral swelling, and also decrease left ventricular hypertrophy by using the CPAP machine. So that's very, very important. And in fact, in our institution, the anesthesiologist will not put them to sleep if they have a diagnosis of sleep apnea requiring CPAP and they're not using it. Just because after surgery, with the anesthesia and the narcotics, there's a higher risk of sudden death. So it is very important if patients need their sleep apnea or CPAP machine that they do wear. The other thing that is important that we'll talk about a little later, that some surgeons do not like or do not allow CPAP the first two nights after surgery because they think that it increases the risk of leak. You know, there's an increased pressure, constant positive airway pressure increases the tension of the anastomosis and causing a leak. I think definitely the benefits of using the CPAP way outweigh the potential, if any, risk of increasing the leak. If we turn to the endocrine system, you know, in our patient population, about 40% are diabetic. And clearly, the higher the blood sugar, or the poorer the blood sugar control prior to surgery, the more morbidity, wound healing, problems like infection. So we try to not operate on anybody with a hemoglobin A1C greater than 11. We try to get them under 7. But that's always a big problem. And so I think, Tasha, this is where you provide a lot of help and assistance in our patients, in patients that are out of control. You know, we're on maxed out on a lot of medication. What are some dietary factors that they can adhere to bring down the blood sugar in a relatively short amount of time, because they're in this window of about 4 to 6 months prior to surgery?
Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, if we're looking at a short period of time before they go to the OR, we might start them on a liquid diet, and a liquid diet works well because it's consistent amounts of carbohydrate being taken in and low amounts of carbohydrate being taken in calories, so it's easy for the patient to do. The one thing that we do if they start a liquid diet is we talk with the doctor or the PAs in adjusting their medication or their insulin so they don't have low episodes of low blood sugar. So, but it can be quite effective. If there's a bigger window of opportunity, then we might work with diet. But again, sometimes if the patient's not real motivated, the liquid diet might be a quicker fix for the problem.
Yeah, and it's very, very important, as we saw in our patient cohort, blood sugar control or tighter blood sugar control prior decreases the risk of infection and wound healing, improves wound healing. The other thing with regards to the endocrine is that in the super obese, the BMI greater than 70, there's been some work looking at giving pre-op growth hormone that sort of increases their metabolic rate, decreases fat mass. But really, it's in experimental, and you have to really start that about a year before to actually get the benefit. But it has been shown to be effective in some individuals. If we turn now to thromboembolic disease preoperatively, you know, everyone talks about the leak, you know, after gastric bypass, but that's a very low incidence. But those are the ones that get very sick. They end up in the ICU. They have a long post-op stay. But the most common cause of mortality in the bariatric surgery patient is pulmonary embolism. We're very cognizant about that, so we take great strides in trying to prevent thromboembolic disease. Do you want to discuss what we do at Geisinger with regards to that and what's recommended?
Sure. I think the most important factor is early ambulation. We try to get patients out of bed and at least to a bedside dangle, if not to a chair, as soon as 6 hours after surgery. And then very quickly, we want to try to get them up and walking. So that early ambulation is key. Other things we do, have patients wear compression stockings, enoxaparin, 40 milligrams every 12 hours. And in some patients, it may be worthwhile to consider a prophylactic inferior vena cava filter prior to surgery.
Yeah, I think that early ambulation, what you said initially, is key. And you know, patients, I think where we've really helped this out is we tell the patients before surgery that we're going to come get you up at 6 hours. So a lot of times, because we want to prevent the dreaded pulmonary embolism. So a lot of times, you know, if they're not at 6 hours and the nurse hasn't come in, they're like, aren't I supposed to be up out of bed? Because I think that has helped greatly. But you're right, early ambulation and the low molecular weight heparins has been shown to be most effective. So, and you want to have induction at the time of surgery.
Yes.
Or you want to use the low molecular weight heparin at the time of induction. A lot of people said, well, because of the risk of bleeding, you want to wait till after the surgery. That's the cat's out of the bag, the horse is out of the barn at that point, because they've been on the table that long. So you really want to start the enoxaparin at the time of induction anesthesia. Good. And you said about the prophylactic IVC filter. Mm-hmm. That is not a benign procedure, as you know. Mm-hmm. So we have specific criteria if they've had a prior DVT, if they have problems with ambulation or not being able to get up after. If they have significant venous stasis changes, then we'll send them to the vascular surgeon to see if they think it is warranted. As I said, we have a big population. The average BMI is about 53 or over 300 pounds. And I think we do few, really, IVC filters for the size of the patients that we do. There's other programs that with a smaller cohort that do a lot more IVC filters. So I think that can't stress enough of early ambulation, compression device, and low molecular weight heparin.